direction the U.S. goes next. However, West Asia is not holding its breath while the U.S. chooses its leader, simply because they've already been there and done that, and no good ever comes out of it. Welcome to the Middle East Stream. I'm Mara Osman. On the eve of the 2020 U.S. presidential election, it remains to be seen whether the Middle East is going to be used to galvanize support for a conservative nationalist foreign policy. In 2016, for instance, Trump's campaign often invoked the Middle East as a region where the U.S. has needlessly squandered blood and treasure. Furthermore, in September 2015, Trump pledged to deport all Syrian refugees, most of whom are Muslim, from the United States. Whereas for his re-election campaign, a paradox seems to be unfolding, with Trump touting his successes in the region as a peace broker. To discuss this issue with us from London is Mr. Patrick Henningsen, who is the founder of the 21st Century Wire. Thank you for being with us, Patrick. Now, for all its stated desire to disentangle itself from the Middle East or the region of West Asia, Washington has really a hard time letting go here. But Biden and Trump represent two markedly different futures for some of the region's political elites in West Asia, especially their leadership in the Israeli entity and in a clutch of oil-rich Arab monarchies. How do you think the results will affect the region of West Asia?
Well, I think on the surface, it might look like they will present two different possibilities, two different scenarios for the Middle East. But if you look at U.S. history, what you'll find is from administration to administration, there's an incredible level of continuity between administrations that might appear to be being from different parties, for instance, or different personalities, totally different, but really the underlying policy is very slow moving in the United States. In the current situation, looking at Syria, looking at Iraq, for instance, there's definitely a drift away from previous policies by the U.S., so they're moving out, essentially, in the larger scheme of things. So, you know, in terms of the Israeli issue, I don't see a massive difference that will happen between a Biden administration and the Trump administration. I think, who knows, the Biden administration could be more beholden to the Israeli lobby or as beholden as the Trump administration. I don't see any noises being made otherwise. Certainly there's some to be gained with some of these other issues at play, like the JCPOA, but I'm not convinced there's going to be a massive difference.
Well, a new U.S. administration could signal a dramatic reversal of Trump's old policies in the region, where it's believed that it would seek maybe to patch the damage that he caused with the Islamic Republic of Iran, especially with the nuclear JCPOA deal, and maybe cool the tensions down. But why should Iran trust any U.S. president if, let alone in 4 years from now, a new, Republican president could come to office and just revoke another agreement?
Well, you've hit the nail right on the head, Marwa. They shouldn't. And I think Iran has learned this lesson. The Islamic Republic of Iran has learned this lesson already. And I think they're moving ahead with their future, with their plans. They should be looking to China to be doing more economic and political deals with China. They should be looking to Russia. They should be looking to their near neighbors as well, looking to strengthen their relationship with Iraq, for instance. And who knows, down the road, there could be better relations between Iran and maybe even some of the Gulf states, possibly, down the road. So I think Iran had made its position known in the last 24 months that it is prepared to defend itself. It's prepared to, wield its own influence within its sphere, within its regional sphere. So the United States knows this very well, and hence that's why you're seeing the U.S. drifting out of the Middle East. Trump has made this a big part of his campaign. We're pulling out, he said, multiple times. So if a Biden administration comes in, the Democrats favor proxy wars. They favor gray area subterfuge, whereas the Republicans like to do things kind of on top, over the table. So there's a different style in terms of intervention or we're flexing muscle internationally, but at the end of the day, the policy is very similar. And the overall trend to me seems the United States is withdrawing its forces, its heavy assets, its soldiers, for instance, from the region, because it's just there's no appetite for it in America right now. Certainly for this election cycle, there isn't. But if Trump gets reelected, who knows? Things could change in a year. But low oil prices is very important for this president. As far as the Biden administration goes, I'd see maybe more similar to an Obama administration or Hillary Clinton style approach.
Patrick, you also touched the main issue here, because the experience of West Asia with the different U.S. Administrations, that they are always hostile to the access of resistance nations. Their hostility is deep-rooted, and there will be no shift, basically, in U.S. foreign policy, especially for West Asia, which is basically aimed at harming civilians, whether through direct wars or through sanctions, which are equally as hostile as wars. However, do you think by continuing this Genghis-style foreign policy, the U.S. will actually be securing its own benefits in the region?
Well, I don't think so. I don't think so. I think things are changing. And you know, the current economic situation in the world, the United States' economy is very fragile. They can't afford high oil prices. People are struggling. Businesses are struggling to make ends meet. So low fuel prices is a big feature in that right now. Certainly, a Democratic administration, they're looking for to wean off of fossil fuels and to move into the green economy. So the Green New Deal, that means a higher fuel prices, maybe a drop in demand in terms of oil and so forth. But the U.S. is pretty energy independent at the moment. That could change. So the need to intervene and the need to micromanage every single aspect of the Middle East is no longer at the top of their priority list as it was maybe 15 years ago. So things have changed in that respect. I think that's overall good news for the region, but there's still problems that exist. The Israeli lobby dictates a Biden-Harris administration. Kamala Harris is very much aligned with AIPAC. I think they would continue very similar policies to the Trump administration.
Well, it's very hard. One very critical foreign policy issue that has almost been entirely absent from the Biden-Trump debates is Iraq, and with it, the U.S. role in the entire rest of Asia. Now, the United States, maybe its place in the world has been greatly shaped, especially over the last 17 years, by its presence in Iraq. Do you think that maybe after this election with a new U.S. administration, the U.S. will actually rethink its illegal presence in Iraq?
Yes, I think that's already happening. I think that's already happening. It's a quagmire that there is really no long-term solution for the United States. I mean, they'll continue to have a presence there, possibly, but really, I think against the overall will of the people in Iraq. So they'll be meddling, certainly in Iraqi Kurdistan, for geostrategic reasons. I think overall, I don't see in the near term, 5 or 10 years, I don't see a big future for the United States on any level in Iraq. And they know that it's only going to exacerbate and cause problems. And Iraq knows that they're not going to be able to stamp out terrorism and fight ISIS with the United States marshaling and micromanaging everything in their country. So they're much more effective. They've shown that. I think even people, realists in Washington, realize that the Iraqis, with the help of Iran, did a tremendous job in rooting ISIS out of the country, whereas the United States has always not been terribly effective in that respect.
Well, I want to thank you very much, Patrick Henningsen, founder of the 21st Century Wire, for joining us to talk about what the U.S. election means for West Asia. Thank you for being with us. Please stay tuned next for more about this matter. as the U.S. presidential election was approaching, President Donald Trump has been pressing more Arab countries to normalize relations with Israel. With the prospects for further normalization are expected to become more challenging next year, future challenges facing the U.S. in the region, as per the Pentagon, are to further pressure Iran, attempt to stabilize the situation in Libya and Iraq, and attempt to put an end to the alliance between Syria and Russia and Iran. U.S. presidential elections fever in West Asia in this following report.
I kept my promise, recognized the true capital of Israel, and opened the American embassy in Jerusalem.
The term reckless is often used to describe Trump's actions in the Middle East, notably the execution of the leader of Iran's Quds Force, Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani, brought extreme uncertainty and raised questions over the U.S.'s approach in an already unstable region. On combating Iran, the Trump administration's reckless approach undercut American influence in the region. Instead, the Trump administration chose to draw on its military primacy to remain as an inevitable actor in the Middle East. Furthermore, the emergent normalization between Arab states and Israel comes at a time when Iran is promoted as a greater threat, and the Palestinian cause isn't considered as much of a prerequisite for peace as it was in the past. Meanwhile, as several countries come to the aid of warring factions in Libya, Trump has found himself caught in the middle of a group of strong men he's forged close ties with during his presidency, prompting him to stay out of the fray and let them fend for themselves, stepping back from any involvement in the country that the U.S. fully destroyed in 2011. Moving on to Yemen, despite the fact that Trump inherited the disaster from his predecessor Barack Obama, but the 45th president has also intensified them. There could be no doubt that Trump has contributed to making Yemen into what Human Rights Watch has described it as the largest humanitarian crisis in the world. Trump has been glad to oversee the intensification of this crisis, bombing and carrying out raids in the country periodically, as well as arming foreign states like Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates to aid in their own warmongering campaigns. Trump's confrontational strategy in West Asia has led to other actors intervening in the region. For instance, in Syria and Libya, Russia is playing a major role, and its resurgence in the region has partly been due to Moscow capitalizing on the U.S. change in policy towards the region. Moreover, the hastiness of American actions in the Middle East towards Trump's extrication aims has also undermined the influence of the U.S. in the region and put regional and international actors at the center of discussions. Hence, the uncertainty and impulsiveness of American decisions in West Asia are expected to only bring more doubt and divide in the foreign policy aspects of the U.S. election. Now to discuss this issue with us from Paris is Mr. Mustafa Fatouri, researcher and political writer and commentator. Thank you for being with us, Mr. Fatouri. Now, Trump and his allies claim that his administration has achieved more in the space of a few years of Middle East politicking than what their predecessors managed over decades. That includes the recent so-called Abraham Accords that were signed between Israel and Bahrain and the United Arab Emirates, normalizing ties with the Israeli occupation. How has that affected maybe the struggle of the Palestinian natives against the Israeli occupation at the moment?
Well, first of all, thank you for having me, Marwa, on the program. And second of all, certainly the latest developments in terms of normalization of relations between the Zionist state and the United Arab Emirates and Bahrain and probably Sudan later on, puts the Palestinians under some kind of disadvantage, at least for the time being, and probably would call on the Palestinians to develop their own struggle in different ways, other than the usual mechanisms, politically speaking, of depending on the consensus of the League of Arab States, which includes most of the Arab countries, that used to have the traditional position of non-normalization with Israel. But certainly it does not kill the Palestinian struggle. This is a very long struggle. It's likely to take longer. And of course, the Palestinian people, just like many others seeking freedom, they will find their way around it, despite the disappointments that we see today.
Well, under the Pentagon scenario for the upcoming U.S. foreign policy, Trump's prospect in the Middle East have been to put Iran in the face of everyone else as an enemy, while strengthening the relationship with maybe Saudi Arabia, Egypt, Jordan, while just maintaining the combative position against Iran, evidently by assassinating Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani at the beginning of this year. Is there any more room for diplomacy in this matter, given all the American warmongering rhetoric?
Well, I think there will be some kind of room, at least in the current impasse between the United States and Iran. We have to remember, in the final analysis, despite what the American administration is doing, I mean the outgoing administration, Trump's administration, has been doing over the last 4 years. We have to remember that Iran, in its geopolitical position, its the kind of influence it enjoys in the region are very vital and very important. And one day the Americans will come down to their senses somehow and find ways to deal with Iran. President Trump himself, if he wins the elections, as I predict he will, he will be embarking in kind of a diplomatic campaign, if you like, towards Iran. He has mentioned it throughout the last 4 years. Many, many times that he wants to deal with Iran, and Iran will find a way to work with him, despite what has been going on both sides in terms of the media. However, we have to remember one important thing here, that the Iranian overall strategy in the region might not be something that brings luxury to the American foreign policy in the area. But in the final analysis, it's very essential, because it has its own allies in the area, which cannot be discounted at all.
Well, moving on maybe to Libya, which is now center of the ongoing scenery in the Middle East, it represents a more complex challenge, maybe owing to the variety and crossover of U.S. interests in the country. Now, the most Trump has done during his presidency for Libya is to call for a ceasefire. Though he has not been actively involved, despite the fact that his predecessor Barack Obama destroyed the country. Do you see any upcoming maybe change in handling the Libyan file by the new U.S. administration?
Well, there should be some kind of different approach. I wouldn't say changing, because changing will be quite difficult for the overall American policy in the area, including in North Africa, where Libya is. We have to remember one important thing here, that America, since the assassination of the late general, the Iranian general earlier this year, America has been in the retreating from the area, including North Africa. And Trump has said many, many times before that he doesn't want to get the U.S. involved in any more troops. When it comes specifically to the Libyan file, I don't expect the Americans to do much in terms of settling the conflict that they have initiated. They have started, as you rightly mentioned, under the Obama administration in 2011. But what I expect them to do is to embark on some kind of diplomatic, probably, campaign to supporting the United Nations mission in the country, which is in Libya, which is leading some kind of efforts now, try to bring about some peaceful settlement into the conflict there. So other than that, I don't really expect much, except the usual rhetoric we have been hearing from them about the Russian involvement, as well as the Turkish involvement, and many others who are key players in the Libyan conflict nowadays.
Well, it is obvious that the Middle East or the region of West Asia will not be a main focus for the U.S. On the contrary, the U.S. is expected to focus on repairing maybe the effects of COVID-19 that has been leaving enormous challenges on the United States of America internally, and in foreign policy terms, maybe they would focus on the Middle East being the fourth priority for them, behind maybe Europe, the Indo-Pacific, and Latin America. Is that good news or bad news for the region? Because maybe bad news meaning leading for further control of Israel.
Well, indeed, it's some kind of a bad news. It depends how you look at it. But we have to remember one of the barrels of the U.S. Middle East policy or regional policy in our area of the world has always been and will always be the defense of Israel, and making Israel superior to its neighbors in terms of military capabilities And that's why they just keep, making available to the Israelis this technology in military equipment. However, if the Americans are really serious about making peace and probably changing their policy approaches into the region, they have to change it, the overall approach they have been applying, at least under the administration, the current administration. We have to remember that the Iranian nuclear deal must be part of that strategy as it was under Mr. Obama, and America has to come back to that deal in some way or form. To be able to deal with the very important regional power, which is Iran in this case. Otherwise, I don't see the Iranians, coming down to any kind of negotiation table, as they have said it before, many times before, through the at least the foreign ministry. Yeah, the second thing is, it's also a bad thing for the Palestinians that will, apply much stress on the Palestinian society, especially in Gaza, where the boycott and the siege has been, affecting people for the last decade or so. And the Palestinians, as I mentioned earlier, must have some kind of, must find a different way to alleviate their misery, as well as come up with some kind of political as well as diplomatic surge in their struggle, which I mentioned earlier will be long, but this is not the end of it.
Well, I want to thank you very much, Mr. Mustafa Fattori, researcher and political writer and commentator, for joining us to talk about how the U.S. presidential elections of 2020 will affect the region of West Asia. Thank you for your contribution, and please stay tuned next week for more from the Mideast Stream.
This is Back to Reality. Back to Reality.
It's the show where we discuss the most topical of topics, the most controversial of controversies, and the most important affairs of affairs.
Roundtable from Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Back to Reality, right? You're going to be floating up into the air. Your head's going to be up in the clouds. We're going to bring you back down to reality. That's right. Today I am here with two very special guests. Oh, I'm Muzaffar Haider, by the way. And I'm here with two very special guests. First of all, on my right, ladies first, sister.
Assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum salam, sister. It's a pleasure to have you.
I'm Sister Nasreen Sayed, and I'm from England, but international, in many places. So thanks for having us here.
Alhamdulillah, good to have you. And brother, yourself, on my left-hand side here.
Hi, assalamu alaikum. My name is Dara from US, and I'm glad to be here. Thank you.
Good to have you both. Okay, so today we're talking about a very open-ended question, a very open-ended discussion. I'm really excited and interested to see what you're going to bring to the table. So the discussion is about satisfaction in life. All right, so it's one of those questions where lots of people, they go throughout life, and they never get that satisfaction. Some people feel like they've gotten that satisfaction, but then they realize one day that they don't, and then they have a midlife crisis. So what are we talking about here?
The satisfaction is a very interesting point, because you have to look at it from different perspective, from the point that, for example, when they say satisfaction guarantee, you go in the market, they say the satisfaction guarantee. That means we are sure that this object, this item, is going to give you happiness and satisfaction. So many people associate the satisfaction with the happiness.
Right.
But what is the real and true satisfaction? We have some terminology that are universal terminologies and general terminologies, general terms. So satisfaction is one of those terms. It's satisfaction from your point of view is different from my point of view. So what is might be satisfaction for me might not be satisfaction for you. The easiest way to look at it and simplest way to look at it is the satisfaction between male and female. For example, what makes the female happy is different than what makes the guy happy.
Right.
For the guy, for example, fighting, challenging, it's satisfaction. It satisfies the person. For the female, it's a love, it's gentleness, it's different. So, again, we have to look where are we looking at the satisfaction?
Right. Okay, so that's the first thing, is objective. Sister?
Okay. This was a beautiful question when I saw it. I come from a perspective of ethics. Philosophy of ethics is what I'm studying right now. And we have different terms, such as the agent and the action and the intention. I put it down to intention. So there is two things, just like when you go into marriage, since the male and the female was mentioned, there's the expectation or there's the duty. Now, either you can go in with an expectation which will never be satisfied, or you can go in with, what is my duty here? What can I do? What can I perform to make this world better, the marriage better, the life better, the day? It's a duty. The purpose that we are created for is the core of achieving satisfaction.
Right.
And if we don't know that, we're just going to go round and round. You mentioned the midlife crisis.
Yeah.
Well, many people have midlife crisis very early, like in their 20s.
I've had mine, yeah.
Yeah, I've had mine. But we do still go through different types, and especially as women.
Right.
When the looks begin to change, there's another type of physical midlife crisis. But anyway, if you're lucky enough to have your midlife crisis early, it's probably because you've been searching earlier.
You know, that's a really interesting point. So, like, even a youth could go through that, and then they lie awake one day and they think to themselves, what have I done with my life? Some people, it just takes them, and this is average people, it takes them a long time. They get to, like, I don't know, like 50 before they realize it, and then, like, well, I need to make a change or something, right?
Mm-hmm.
But no, that's a really interesting point. And also, I'd like to get Brother's opinion on this. The idea that, you know, Sister mentioned that your disconnection from your duty in life, because I've also studied Aqaid, and in there they teach us that distancing oneself from their purpose in life actually creates disharmony, dissatisfaction, unhappiness. What's your take on that?
Yeah, actually, I was going to expand on that. It's very interesting what the sister said. To continue what this she said is that the satisfaction in life, we have to see what is a life is, because we're discussing the satisfaction in the life.
Mm-hmm.
So do we see the life only today or the moment or the second as a now, or we see it like 5 years, 10 years, 20 years, or just living in this world? Mm. Or we see the life in this world and hereafter.
Subhanallah. Right.
So now we want to see the satisfaction. So depends how do you look at it, and what is your expand of your mind?
Mm.
How big is your heart?
Mm.
How much do you want? Mm. Based on how much do you want, you can be satisfied.
Yeah, I mean, if
dimensions
just,
of what you want.
Right.
Do you want? Is it an external? Or the way I personally see Islam is it is a creation. It's an act of creation, sort of experienced through connecting with the Quran, through connecting with the Ahlul Bayt, through the allegiances. The Quran is the creation, right? The Quran is the way that Allah creates through us, because we see the beginning in Surah Yasin, where Allah tells us that He says, "Be and it is." Right? Kun fayakun. Now, the other one is about the Arabic Quran. The Arabic Quran is the Arabic Imam Jafar Sadiq is the word of God.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Mm.
So, and the breath. Allah breathed His breath into, Allah breathed His soul into Adam. Okay, so all this is going into, there's an input and there's an output. The input, we have to take in the input to create ourselves, and then the output is our act of creation, which is through our recitation first, and then through our behavior.
Yeah, if you'll permit me, so
I might be going a little bit deep.
Are you saying that every step of our lives we are essentially creating
or
something
destroying.
New? We're creating ourselves.
Or
we're
destroying.
Writing.
Yeah.
Or destroying ourselves.
Yeah.
That's
and
yeah.
We cannot create anything without Allah, so that means without the connection. And Imam Jafar Sadiq says, when he was asked, what is our right on... How many verses, he was asked, how many verses of Quran do we recite today? He said, it is the haqq of Quran that you recite 50. Then they asked, how? And he said, recite it in the way that the Arabs recite and understand it.
Right.
So therefore, right there, in my understanding, it's two. You must recite it because the Arabic is for the soul and the body and the heart, to create the human being.
Subhanallah, right.
While we're still animals, because not everyone was born a human being.
Yeah.
And then the native tongue is for the intellect,
right,
to make the connection between the soul and the...
You know, what's fascinating is that the Qur'an is one of those keys and one of those portals towards satisfaction. I mean, that is really what it's leading humanity towards.
The only thing. And it has to be too, because there is a manifestation of that Qur'an, and that is the Ahlabayt.
Right.
And if we see in Karbala that, in my opinion, the core, everyone has their own, I think, perception of the core message.
Mm-hmm.
But for me, the core message is allegiance.
Right.
That... Right. We say we follow Imam Ali, the Ahlabayt, the Imam Zaman, may Allah hasten his reappearance. But what is the initial step in to do that?
Mm-hmm.
The Imam said that do not oppress the days.
Mm-hmm.
They ask, who are the days? Or they ask, what is the days? I'm not sure. He said, we are the days.
Days?
The days.
Like the 24 hours?
Yeah.
Days?
We are the days. Uh-huh. Every Imam or group of Imams... You know, sometimes it's one, sometimes it's four, sometimes it's three, has their day.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
if we don't pledge allegiance to the right ones,
right,
then we are pledging allegiance.
Ah, like, for example, Friday is the day of Imam Zaman.
Yeah,
like,
exactly. Okay, so there are certain ziyarats we are given
yes.
to do.
That's right.
Ziyarats means allegiance, means verbally
yeah.
sort of testifying
yeah.
that I am on your side. And if we don't, then we have no connection.
I want to drag Brother in at this moment. He was just reaching for his tea, so I have to stop him from doing that, to be mean.
Very interesting you mentioned that Quran is a satisfaction by itself.
Right.
And the sister mentioned about the day.
Mm.
What I just came to my mind was that Quran is a satisfaction.
Mm-hmm.
So you said Quran is the satisfaction. And we know the Quran is a light.
Yes.
And we know the Ahl al-Bayt are the light as well. Kulluhum nurun wahid. So we have the light.
Light upon light.
So the light is a satisfaction. So what is the ultimate light?
Right.
The ultimate light is Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala.
Uh-huh.
So that's the true satisfaction. So
yeah, until there you is see no the light.
And that is what we're creating in ourselves.
There you go.
We're removing the darkness.
Mm-hmm.
You know, people, I think there's a lot of misunderstanding between intellect and understanding.
Yeah, no, I just wanted to bounce off that one idea that you gave about oppressing oneself.
Mm-hmm.
We often forget that when we're sinning, we're not actually hurting anyone else other than ourselves. And it's referred to in the Quran as a dhulm, as a oppression or an injustice or, you know. But dhulm actually means darkness. That's what it actually means. Al-dhulumat. It means the darknesses, right? So that's what we're doing. And that's a beautiful point that we've just raised there collectively, you know, about the light actually getting... We are creating the light, and it's the light of Allah. And we're getting rid of the darkness within ourselves. So that's actually an incredible point.
You know,
the
point that you mentioned about the dhulm, when I mentioned that, you know, we're all oppressors, right? We're all committing oppression in every on different degrees. If you look at the Risalat al-Uquq by Imam Zain al-Abidin alayhi salam, you'll see there's 50 duties in there. And the first one is the right of ourselves to Allah, the right of Allah.
Wow. Yeah.
So that is the worship. And the worship has different forms and levels, but the beginning of it is like ourself testifying with, not just testifying, you know, like one brother who became a Muslim once, he said, they asked him, how did you become a Muslim? And he said, I said, la 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 la, and I was a Muslim. So that was sweet. But, you know, it's not about just saying la 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 la. It's about
connecting
our, you know, our heart, our intention, that our intention is for the right cause, for Allah.
So when we're talking about satisfaction, we're talking about the Qur'an. We've now linked to the Qur'an to it as well. There's one verse that comes to mind. I'm sure the brother knows it as well. يَا أَيَّتُهَا النَّفْسُ الْمُطْمَئِنَّ أَرْجِعِي إِلَى رَبِّكِ رَاضِيَةً مَرْضِيَةً. This is about Imam Hussein. Surah Fajr is actually referred to as the Surah of Imam Hussein as well.
Mm.
Now, one of the beautiful things that it shows us is that, look, what is it saying, first of all? O self-assured soul, this soul which has acquired this satisfaction, return to your Lord. He is pleased with you and you are pleased with him, right? this is the pinnacle of satisfaction.
Yeah.
Right? But he didn't get it through anything dunyawi.
No.
Because this is where the real crux of the issue is. When you talk about satisfaction, you know, you raised the point about product, consumer satisfaction, and that's what it's become. People see it in a completely materialistic sense. Yeah. But actually, you could never have dunyawi satisfaction. But you can get satisfaction in terms of the akhirah, in terms of your spiritual growth, in terms of getting that closeness to Allah. That's the real satisfaction.
The satisfaction is in the heart, right? The satisfaction is not anywhere else. And the heart is the revolution between the animal self and the human self. So if we have not connected our heart to, practically speaking now, to the Quran, to the Holy Prophet, and to Imam Ali first, Imam Ali is the gate.
Yes.
Well, what is the gate on us? It's the heart. And what is the city of knowledge? It's the brain. Imam Ali is the connector of a humanity.
Mm.
Right? He is the beginning of ethics.
Yeah, the
and
Holy
until
Prophet
then
said,
we have morality.
He said, "Ana madinatul ilm wa Aliun babuha." I'm the city of knowledge and Ali is its gate. So I can totally understand
yeah,
that.
Yeah, you can understand it, but unless we break it up explain the morality versus ethics, we won't understand that morality is the behavior, but ethics is the heart.
Right. You've reminded me of another hadith now. Imam Ali alayhi salam, he said, "I stood at the gate of my heart and let nothing inside except God."
Wow.
You see, is this not satisfaction? If we could ever reach that stage, Allah give us tawfiq, inshallah, to reach that stage where nothing goes inside, nothing like affects us except for the light of Allah, except for the nur of Allah. Fascinating discussion that we've had today. I'd like to thank the two honorable guests that we've had, from myself and from brother and from
thank
sister.
You.
Bid you assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Ya Allah. يا رب العالمين يا رحمن يا رحيم يا ربي let the ummah rise again يا الله يا رب العالمين يا رحمن يا رحيم يا ربي let the ummah rise again, let us see daylight again, once again.
Join us in this journey, IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. The program is Dialogue, and I'm your host, Mahdi. Today we want to talk about one of the great personalities in the early history of the Muslims, Imam Muhammad al-Baqir alayhi salam. Please stay tuned. Imam Muhammad al-Baqir was the direct descendant of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, and he was the fifth divinely appointed Imam among the household of the Holy Prophet. He was the son of the fourth divinely appointed Imam, Imam Ali ibn al-Husayn alayhi salam. Now all historians and traditionalists of Islam are unanimous that among the descendants of Imam Hassan and Imam Husayn, a maximum of religious sciences were expounded by Imam Muhammad al-Baqir. That is why the title of al-Baqir was given to the Imam, which denotes one who splits knowledge. Imam al-Baqir contributed greatly to the science of Quranic exegesis, scholastic theory, religious law, and Islamic jurisprudence, among many other subjects.
قال الإمام الباقر عليه السلام إن السواك في السحر قبل الوضوء من السنة.
Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam stated, "Verily, brushing one's teeth at dawn before performing the ablutional wudu is part of recommended prophetic practice."
Welcome back, dear friends. It's an honor and a blessing to have you with us on the program. You're listening to Dialogue on IRIB English Radio. Now, we find a very interesting dialogue between Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam and the Umayyad Caliph Umar bin Abdul Aziz. And so in this dialogue between Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam and Umar bin Abdul Aziz, Imam al-Baqir gives some useful commandments to Umar bin Abdul Aziz about managing his government. Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam says to him to treat the young ones of the Muslims in society as your sons and thus have mercy on them. Treat the middle ones in age in among the Muslims in the society as your brother and treat your brother kindly. And finally, treat the old people of the Muslims in your society as your father and obey their wise sayings. Now, in reply to this statement in this dialogue, Umar bin Abdul Aziz really admired this maxim, this saying of Imam al-Baqir, and he himself in this dialogue said, "By Allah, you, Imam al-Baqir, have gathered things, accumulated things, brought things together. If we put these things into effect and Allah helps us with them, good will continue for us, inshallah, Allah willing." So these valuable words have brought together only political affairs, but in reality, when the head of the state rules or governs his subjects with justice and fairness and mercy and kindness and regards the people in the society as members of his or her own family, then the government and the people are happy and good continues to come for them. Very beautiful and valuable lesson, especially in today's time, and especially for political leaders and governments all around the world, that we should have a just system, we should have a fair system, we should have a kind system, we should have a merciful system, and treat the people as members of a family, so that good continues to be blessed upon us all. A beautiful lesson, profound indeed, in this dialogue brought to us by Imam Al-Baqir alayhi salam. And now we invite you to listen to Sayyid Muhammad Ridhvi.
Just to let you know that when you hear these fatwa from our mujtahideen, you know, people ask this question, oh, mujtahids are giving fatwa, where does it come from? Well, the fatwa in most cases basically are based on the ahadith of the imams of the Ahlul Bayt. Or even if it's not exactly from the wordings of the ahadith, it is based on the principles derived from the Quran and the ahadith of the Ahlul Bayt. And I would like to actually clarify some of the issues. I hear again and again, it's really surprising. We should have moved, you know, beyond these issues long, long time ago. The issue of food, what is halal and what is haram. And so what I've done is selected some of the ahadith of the fifth Imam, you know, just to have a general perspective of this from the perspective of the ahadith of Imam Muhammad al-Baqir alayhi salatu wassalam. Let me start with a couple of ahadith about non-meat products. The general principle which should help us in making the decision whether this is halal or haram, when it comes to non-meat products, the guiding rule is that everything is halal for you unless you come to know it is haram. Keep this in your mind. كل شيء لك حلال حتى تعلم أنه حرام. Everything, as far as non-meat products are concerned, you start with the assumption that this is halal for you unless you find out or you come to know the opposite of that. An example here would be of food items. There was a question, somebody by the name of Abu Ayyub, narrating from Al-Kunnasi. He says, I asked the Imam, the fifth Imam, and his samni wal jubun, tajiduhu fi ardi al-mushrikeen fi al-Rum. Very relevant to our situation. This person asked the Imam about, you know, cheese and oil, which he would buy in the land of the kuffar in Rome from non-Muslims in a non-Muslim country. And na'akuluhu, should are we allowed to eat that? And Imam says, amma ma 'alimta minhu annahu qad khalatahu al-haram fala ta'kuluhu. If you know about the cheese or the oil, that something haram has been included in it, if you know about it, فَلَا تَأْكُلُهُ, then do not eat it. وَأَمَّا مَا لَمْ تَعْلَمْ, but if you don't know whether it has been mixed with haram, فَكُلُهُ حَتَّى تَعْلَمْ عَنَّهُ حَرَام, then eat it. You're allowed to eat that until you come to know that it is haram. So when it comes to simple things like non-meat products, the ruling and the guiding principle is, it is halal for you until you come to know it is haram.
Thank you very much, dear friends, for listening to this episode of Dialogue. Don't forget to log on to our website at parstoday.com. Until another episode, God bless you and fi amanillah.
Sisters in 2020. Educational institutions in the U.S. were supposed to represent equality of opportunity, but there are still persisting inequalities at the heart of America's educational system. Hundreds of thousands of American students have been exposed to gun violence during school hours, and there has been a large number of deadly shooting incidents at American schools. Experts have also labeled the issue of student debt. That's a big problem. It's called a national crisis at this point, which is dragging down the economy, fueling the racial wealth gap, and even destroying lives. Then teachers, they're frustrated. Although their job comes with unique challenges, the majority of them earn a solid middle-class wage at best. Hello, and welcome to Decision 2020. I'm Kavit Athwaite. Yet unfortunately, the topic we've covered in this program, like the U.S. educational system, is not the one being covered by mainstream candidates.
In the United States, the school system is viewed as an educational ladder, a concept used by the Americans to reflect the value of individual success and the equal opportunity for working one's way to the top. However, although the Civil Rights Acts of the mid-1960s eventually ended, the legality of the infamous practice of school segregation and educational inequality in the U.S., students still receive dramatically different learning opportunities based on their social status. In many areas, the cost of education is rising much more rapidly than the average family income is. There are striking differences between white and non-white students' access to key educational resources, including skilled teachers, quality curriculum, sufficient funding, and essential classroom materials. Schools receive a large percentage of their money from local property taxes. As a result, the wealthier school districts offer better educational opportunities. Recent reports show that predominantly white school districts receive nearly $23 billion more in funding than other non-white school districts, despite serving roughly the same number of students. This shows that racial gaps and residential patterns are directly linked to educational disparities in the U.S.
A series of university research in the year 2019 surprisingly showed that New York schools are the most segregated in the U.S. That revealed that they not only isolated students by race, but also by their socioeconomic status. Let's hear more about that.
We have such a disparity between schools that largely serve black and Latino populations, and then the small number of schools that white parents tend to send their children to. And so I've been covering school segregation for a long time, but then had my own child who was 4 years old, and I was having to suddenly pick a school for her in this very segregated system.
Even if these schools were roughly equivalent academically, as that would still be a violation of the principle of Brown versus Board of Education that separate educational facilities are inherently unequal. But in practice, they are very rarely equal in any way. Black and Latino children are more likely to attend schools with inexperienced teachers, which are then less likely to offer a college prep curriculum. On top of which, because race and class are inextricably linked, those students are six times as likely to be in high poverty schools. And while there are teachers and students working incredibly hard in those places, they are often doing so with fewer resources.
Okay, I mean, talking about this in the year 2020 is quite incredible. All right, Nicole Hannah-Jones, author of New York Times Magazine article, Choosing a School for My Daughter, is what you heard there, along with John Oliver, just courtesy of them, in order to bring the point across. Well, having heard that, let's get our first guest in and hear the guest's opinion about the ongoing racism crisis that's happening at U.S. schools and the potential political solutions for this problem. James Brewer is an assistant professor of social foundations of education at the University of North Georgia with expertise in education policy surrounding issues of public schools, the privatization of schools, and issues of equity and justice. Hello, Jameson. Welcome to Decision 2020. First question, the U.S. has a clear two-pronged approach when it comes to schooling, with white middle classes being at a clear advantage compared to the black lower classes. How do you think that this should be addressed when it comes to each of the mainstream candidates?
I think that it's clear that the United States has a historical an equity issue when it comes to racial justice across our society, but especially in our schools. Something that we learned just last year that we've always known intuitively is that schools that dominantly serve white students receive approximately an additional $23 billion in funding per year. Now, of course, the significant portion of that difference is because the way that we fund schools is heavily dependent on property taxes here in the United States.
Wow, interesting point that he makes there. We appreciate that, James Brewer. He talked about equity issue and how white students are receiving, the schools that is, $20 billion more when it comes to their budget in terms of property taxes, perhaps. And, of course, that is a clear disadvantage for the schools that have people of color in it. Well, when we take a look at the way that this situation is evolving in the U.S., keeping the schools safe is another challenge that U.S. administrations have been facing amid a steady rise in school shootings all across the country in the past decades.
Research shows that a majority of American teenagers are worried about the possibility of a shooting happening at their schools. Many students and parents are outraged by what they refer to as gross incompetence on part of school and law enforcement officials. They have repeatedly called for gun legislation and further school safety measures, but different U.S. administrations, whether Republican or Democrat, have flip-flopped on their pledges for new gun control laws. Although some state legislators have passed several gun control regulations in recent years, the National Rifle Association continues to press lawmakers to prioritize the interests of gun owners across the U.S. That shows that the fate of hundreds of thousands of innocent children lies in the hands of one of the most powerful lobby groups in the U.S., the foremost defender of the country's controversial Second Amendment of the right of the people to keep and bear arms.
Anxiety over potential school shootings has created a common fear among Americans, and many people persistently use any platform that they have to express their anger towards these senseless tragedies. Okay. Back to our guest, James Brewer, professor of Social Foundations of Education, UNG, to talk about this violent practice and its consequences for the U.S. education system. James Brewer, welcome back. Gun crime and mass shootings is a major issue in schools in the U.S. Having seen multiple occasions where atrocities have been committed on school grounds, how do you think education can actually play a part in ending gun crime?
I think that it's also clear that the United States has a gun violence problem. I think that we have in this country approximately 2 to 3 guns for every person in our country. So I think that the answer to the question, I think that schools can play a part. I think that clearly teachers and educators and administrators and counselors think that they can, and historically they always have been, and we can continue to serve students and serve community needs and provide resources for students who are hurting, provide resources to communities and the broader society. But I think that the answer to the question, I think it has to come from a broad societal sort of examination of how this country approaches particularly gun ownership, but also the mass expansion of gun ownership over the past few decades, because I think that teachers and educators can play a part, but I think it'd be very difficult for teachers and schools by themselves to fix what is in effect a societal issue.
Okay, thank you very much. That is James Brewer, professor of Social Foundations of Education at UNG, with his comments on that. But I mean, he makes a lot of good suggestions, granted, but how can the U.S. president, who's saying that Democrat-run cities are the ones that are suffering from crime, if he's segregating it into those two categories, red and blue states, do you think there's going to be any solutions?
The U.S. economy largely relies on its vast infrastructure network. But these systems were built decades ago and they suffer from comparatively low quality. Experts have warned about safety concerns, and the American Society of Civil Engineering has given the U.S. infrastructure a low grade. daily inconveniences for longer commutes, structural deficiency for bridges, antiquated drinking water, internet provision, wastewater systems, and air transportation all need upgrades and observations. That is why other developed countries enjoy more reliable and efficient services. Meanwhile, different polls show that the majority of American people and businesses support rebuilding the infrastructure. So why is the U.S. lagging behind its international peers, such as France, Germany, and Japan?